Oyez, oyez, oyez. The Honorable Supreme Court of Texas is now in session and soon to adjourn.
Thank you. Be seated. This morning, the court has only two matters left on its oral submission docket, and in the order in which they will be heard, they are as follows. Arta Mae Little as independent executrix of the estate of Frank J. Little, M.D. and others, versus Catherine Irene Barber Smith from Grayson County. And Harvey K. Huey, Jr., individually and as independent executor of the estate of Ellen M. Huey, deceased and trustee of the Melissa Huey Chenault Trust, versus the Honorable Nikki DeShazzo on original mandamus proceedings. In each of these causes, the court has allotted 20 minutes for oral argument to be presented by petitioners or relator and 20 minutes for respondent. Petitioners or relator may reserve a portion of this time for a rebuttal by so advising the marshal of the court. We will take a brief recess in between the presentation of the arguments. If you desire to listen to purchase a tape of these arguments, you may make application with the clerk of our court. The court is undertaking a self-study run by the National Center of State Courts, and we are very privileged to have with us in the audience today three justices from other Supreme Courts who will be helping us understand what we might do better. Chief Justice Alma Wilson of the Oklahoma Supreme Court and Justices Thomas Lackett of Arizona and Henry Fry of North Carolina, and we welcome you here. I think there are other people from the National Center for State Courts and members of the Texas Bar and the Texas academic community who may be here, and we appreciate your watching this portion of our work and then visiting with us later today and tomorrow about other portions. We are ready to hear argument from petitioners in Little versus Smith.
May it please the court, I am Joe Wolf Sherman. This is a suit for determination of heirship and for damages based on an illegitimate child's exclusion from an estate. Plaintiff is claiming to inherit through her alleged natural mother. This case involves reconstruction of events.
Counsel, is there any dispute, you say alleged mother, isn't there any dispute that it's been established?
We have agreed for summary judgment purposes, yes, Your Honor.
So she's not alleged?
Yes, sir, for summary judgment purposes, that is correct, Your Honor. The case involves reconstruction of events spanning a period of approximately 60 years. How might a modern soundbite or media headline summarize all these events? It might be, illegitimate child, age 59, seeks share of estate 8 years after estate is closed. A subheadline might be, claimant had no contact with so-called birth family for over 57 years. I believe the fundamental issue in this lawsuit is whether an illegitimate child can maintain a suit for damages against the executor and distributees of an estate based upon the plaintiff's exclusion from the estate when the suit isn't filed for nearly 8 years after the estate has been closed. When this lawsuit was filed in 1991, yes, Your Honor.
Are you arguing that you don't recognize a cause of action, or is your argument on the latter part of your statement that it's barred?
It's barred. That's our argument, Your Honor. When this lawsuit was filed in 1991, the plaintiff, Catherine Smith, was 59 years old. She had attained her majority in 1952. Her alleged birth mother, Thelma Little, had been dead for 22 years. Her alleged natural grandmother, Lula Little, had been dead for 9 years. The estate in question, the Lula Little estate, had been closed for nearly 8 years. When this lawsuit was filed in 1991, the only remaining member, the only surviving member of the Little family with firsthand knowledge of whether or not Thelma had given birth to an illegitimate child in 1932 was her brother, Dr. Frank Little. Dr. Little died in 1993, less than 2 years after the lawsuit was filed, and so he is no longer able to defend his sister or himself.
He did give a deposition.
Yes, sir, he did.
Mr. Wolf, you cited in your brief authorities from Texas and the U.S. Supreme Court authorities.
Yes, ma'am.
Have other states had occasion to deal with any of these issues?
If so, Your Honor, I haven't conducted the research into that. I think the main authority that we relied on was Reed versus Campbell and then the Turner case that was fairly recently decided by the Austin Court of Appeals, and those were our two chief authorities. The evidence in the case shows that even though Mrs. Smith knew from age 10 that she was adopted, she made no serious inquiry into the identity of her natural parents until 1989, when she was 57 years old. She was asked during her deposition why she had made no inquiry until 1989, when she testified that she had been frightened to try. There is no reasonable explanation in the record as to why Mrs. Smith did not obtain Thelma's name from her adoptive mother prior to her adoptive mother's death in 1982.
When are you contending that this cause of action, which you conceded, arose?
December 31st, 1983, which was the date that Dr. Little filed an affidavit closing the Lula Little estate.
So if the estate had never closed, this cause of action would still be open today or forever?
That is conceivable. I think we place heavy reliance, Your Honor, on the fact that the estate was fully distributed and closed as of December 31st, 1983. The plaintiff sued Dr. Little individually and his executor and some 15 other defendants, claiming to be entitled to a share of the Lula Little estate and claiming damages based on her exclusion.
What's the value of the estate?
We estimated that her 1/12th share in the estate was approximately $33,000. The defendants filed a motion for summary judgment on the grounds of limitations and public policy. The trial court granted the motion. The Court of Appeals affirmed with respect to the claim of heirship, but reversed and remanded on the damages portion of the suit on the grounds that there is a fact question as to when limitations accrue. The logical result, we say, of the Court of Appeals decision is that 20, 30, or 50 years or more after an estate has been distributed and closed, an adopted person can file suit for damages and obtain a jury trial based on a claimed exclusion from a share of the estate. This is so because under the Court of Appeals decision, if an adopted person files suit within 2 or 4 years after he discovers the names of his natural parents, there would almost certainly be a fact question as to when limitations accrue. The effect of the Court of Appeals decision is that there can be no finality to distribution of estates because the distributees and the personal representatives remain vulnerable indefinitely to causes of action based on exclusion from distribution of an adopted person or an illegitimate child.
Why does that keep the estate from being filed?
Because it makes no sense from our point of view, Your Honor, that the heirship claim is barred, but the plaintiff can still sue the distributees and the executor for damages. It makes no difference, we believe, as a practical matter, that she is barred from asserting her claim of heirship if she still has a claim for damages.
Would the damages, are the damages alleged the share of the estate that she would have received?
Well, it's based on her exclusion. This is a problem that I have with the Court of Appeals decision, as we've stated in the application, that it's very difficult to resolve how she can sue for damages based on being excluded as an heir when she no longer has a claim to be an heir of the estate. I know of no other foundation for damages other than her exclusion from the estate. And the Court of Appeals has said that that's barred. I would like to quickly review some significant facts contained in the summary judgment record, which I believe can be summarized most favorably to the plaintiff as follows. As mentioned, she claims to have been born as the illegitimate daughter of Thelma Little in Sherman in 1932, and Thelma was 18 years old in 1932. The plaintiff was received in Hope Cottage in Dallas the day following her birth. She never had any contact with her birth mother after she was born. She never had any contact with any member of the Little family for the next 57 years until 1989. During the intervening years between 1932 and 1989, the following significant events occurred. In 1933, the plaintiff was adopted from Hope Cottage by Mr. and Mrs. Barber, Paris, Texas. In that same year, Thelma married Sterling Park, and there were two children born of that marriage. By the time the plaintiff was 10, in 1942, her adoptive mother, Mrs. Barber, had told her that she had been born in Sherman on March 22, 1932, that she had been adopted from Hope Cottage in Dallas, and that her natural parents resided in Sherman. In that same year, 1942, there was filed an affidavit with the Texas Department of Health, signed by one Emily Jones, stating that the plaintiff had been born to Thelma Little in Sherman in 1932. In 1952, the plaintiff got married, and there were two children of that marriage. In 1960, Thelma's mother, Lula Little, signed a will leaving all of her property equally to her five children, including Thelma. In 1969, Thelma died at age 55, survived by the two children born of her marriage to Sterling Park. In 1982, Thelma's mother, Lula Little, died with the will that she had signed in 1960. There was no provision in the will stating what would happen to Thelma's share if Thelma predeceased her mother. Lula Little's will was admitted to probate in 1982, and Dr. Little was appointed independent executor. Under the anti-lapse statute, Thelma's share was distributed to the two children who were born of marriage to Sterling Park.
Let me
interrupt.
If had the claim been timely made, and there was that clause in the will, that would perhaps have entitled her to a share of the estate. But if the will had certain beneficiaries who are named and alive, would an illegitimate adopted child have any right to the estate?
I believe not, Your Honor.
It's only because of
the way the will was worded, and it was never rewritten after 1960, 22 years later. Lula Little died, and as I mentioned, then the anti-lapse statute applied. Also in 1982, the plaintiff's adoptive mother died. As I mentioned, on December 31st, 1983, Dr. Little filed the affidavit closing the Lula Little estate. Other than random talks with her adoptive mother, the plaintiff made no inquiry into the identity of her natural parents until 1989.
Why wouldn't she be charged with put on notice or a duty of inquiry at some point after she was told that she was adopted?
That's our point, Your Honor. We say that she was. We say that...
But you say that duty didn't start running for legal purposes till December of 1983.
We say she should have that information prior to that date if she had exercised reasonable care and diligence to inform herself of Thelma's name. Then she could have timely presented a claim or timely made her identity known and participated if it were determined at that time that she was, in fact, an illegitimate daughter of Thelma. Yes, sir.
It is very difficult for a 10-year-old to know where to start in making reasonable inquiries and protecting her legal rights.
Yes,
limitations cannot run against a minor.
She attained her majority, Your Honor, in 1952, and we believe at that time that as an adult, she would have been presumed to know the law that she was entitled to inherit from and through her natural parents.
You're claiming that at best she had 2 years after she became 18, she became an adult, and the limitations barred any claims she may have had after age 20?
No, Your Honor. We're saying that after she reached her majority, then she had ample opportunity to inform herself of the identity of her natural parents, and that was an ongoing opportunity that existed all the way up to the time that she actually did make an inquiry. The reason this is important is because of the discovery rule. And we feel that it is inherent in the discovery rule that she must have made a reasonable inquiry, that she must have used reasonable care and diligence to inform herself.
Why should the discovery rule apply at all?
I think that's an excellent question, Your Honor, because I don't believe the information was inherently undiscoverable. We say that the information was readily discoverable, as shown by what happened in 1989.
So your position is not simply that she cannot establish its applicability in this case, but that it doesn't even apply?
Yes, sir.
Why did you choose December 31 of 83 as the date the cause of action accrued as opposed to some earlier date, such as the date there was a publication in the newspaper saying if you have a claim against the estate, you need to come forward? Why do you pick a later date?
I can't explain other than we felt that that was a very clear date that the estate was closed and that an affidavit was filed stating to whom the estate had been distributed and that the estate was closed at that time.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. Court is ready to hear oral argument from the respondent.
May it please the court, Mr. Northrup will present argument for respondent.
May it please the court. My name is Mike Northrup, and I represent the respondent, Catherine Smith, and she's also a cross-petitioner in this court. If Frank Little had filed an application for determination heirship pursuant to the Texas Probate Code, sections 48 to 56, I would not be standing before this court today. It is our position that when there is a missing or lost heir that is entitled to recover a portion of an estate, that those provisions impose a duty upon the executor or administrator of an estate to have an ad litem appointed by the court. The ad litem is then required to exercise due diligence to try to locate that missing or unknown heir.
When there is a will that has been admitted to probate?
Yes, and in the event that there is a lost or unknown heir to the estate that's entitled to take.
I don't understand the duty that you allege is owed by the family of the decedent.
Okay.
I'll
be happy to address that. While the question of duty was not really addressed in this motion for summary judgment, it is our position and the underpinnings for our cause of action is that the probate places a duty on the executor to have an ad litem appointed pursuant to these provisions to locate Catherine Smith in this particular instance. The reason that the other
in every instance where a will is admitted to probate, it's your contention that
no, not in every instance. Only when there is an heir that the executor knows is entitled to a portion of that estate and they don't know where the heir is. In this particular instance, it is our position that Frank Little knew that Catherine Smith was one of those heirs and that she was entitled to take a portion of this estate through the anti-lap statute because Lula Little's daughter, Thelma, had predeceased her.
What evidence is there that he knew?
There is evidence that there's evidence in the record from my client who testified at her deposition that she had contacted, I think it's one of the members of the family, it would be Betty Sue LeBrun or Betty Sue Little, and that Betty Sue basically informed her that, yeah, we knew about you, that Lula Little basically told us on your deathbed that there's another daughter for Thelma. That's the evidence that we have that she knew. Dr. Little did in fact deny that he knew.
Now he's dead.
Pardon?
And now he's dead.
That's exactly right.
And one of the reasons for limitations is to keep from having to try cases when the witnesses are gone.
I understand that.
Why shouldn't it apply in a case like that?
It should not apply in this case for the reasons that were set out by Justice Enoch in the recent opinion of Computer Associates versus Altai, that this is an inherently undiscoverable case or inherently undiscoverable injury to my client. The discovery rule should apply to this particular case for that reason. Not only the Court of Appeals found that it was inherently undiscoverable because my client is adopted and because all of her birth records were sealed, and the only way you can get them under statute is you have to show good cause. The courts in Texas, or at least in Dallas, have considered medical reasons to be good cause for getting those birth records. I'm not sure that's what Justice Enoch had in mind in Computer Associates versus Altai when he said that there has to be objective physical evidence and that it has to be inherently undiscoverable. I think what he had in mind in that case, or from what I read from the case, is that it has to be looked at from the perspective of the particular cause of action. Is it a cause of action for breach of fiduciary duty? Is it a cause of action for fraud? And in that opinion, he acknowledged what all other discovery rule type opinions have held, and that is that if there is a fiduciary relationship, and there is in this case because Dr. Frank Little, as executor of the estate, had a fiduciary relationship to the beneficiaries of the Lula Little estate, that the inherent undiscoverability prong of the test is established.
If Ms. Little had died in 1940 and still had, the plaintiff in this case still had not found out until 1989, same result.
Same result. And I think it's a justified result in this case because the duty in this case, assuming that Dr. Frank Little did know, and that's something that on a retrial we'll have to establish in order to recover. But assuming that he knew and the other heirs knew that Catherine Smith was an heir or was out there and was entitled to take, it's appropriate to place the duty on the parties that are most likely to know that she was in error. She didn't know who her family was. In fact, the records that would have told her that were sealed. And only if she could establish good cause could she have ever found that out.
What do you think Dr. Little should have done?
I believe what he should have done was to go to the court under the application for determination of heirship, apply to have an ad litem appointed by the court, and then the ad litem is supposed to exercise due diligence to try to locate this individual. If the ad litem exercises due diligence and returns to the court and says, I've looked, I can't find the heir, then Dr. Frank Little's duty is satisfied. On the other hand...
What does the ad litem do? Where does he start?
He can start by interviewing the members of the family, determine what
and
they
ask
know.
Him, did your mother have an illegitimate daughter that we don't know about?
Yes, exactly. That's what gives rise to the reason for the appointment in the first place, is the family, in the event that they know.
What if they dispute that there is a child? What is that situation? What is the obligation where they can test?
That's a good question. And I guess it's not, I have to reiterate that that's not really a question that was presented by the motion for summary judgment, the question of duty, but I'll attempt to answer it to the best I can. I think that in the event that there is a question, that even in that instance, there is an obligation to go out and look. From talking, I guess, with some probate lawyers about this, I'm not really a probate lawyer, but from talking with them, it was their impression that even if there is a question, is there a lost or unknown heir, that the obligation is to be absolutely certain that you've got it covered. And this doesn't arise, I don't know how often this even arises. It arose in this case only by virtue of the anti-lapse statute. We had a will in this particular instance that disposed of all the property, except it was unforeseen, or at least the will wasn't changed after Thelma Little passed away. And the Texas anti-lapse statute says that that particular property should go to the issue of Thelma Little. And Catherine Smith, my client, was one of those issue, which the records, I believe it's attached to our brief as Appendix C, shows who all the, it's the, I guess, her birth records or the record from Hope Cottage showing who all the members of the family are.
If there, when matter is filed for probate, is there some sort of public notice when?
I believe there was, and in fact, in this particular instance, there was a newspaper publication or a notice published in the newspaper.
So if I know that I'm an heir and I am not included in the heirship proceedings mm-hmm. when it's filed, I can never urge the discovery rule because, as a matter of constructive notice, I got it.
That's exactly true.
So, really, your point is that not that you weren't charged with notice of the heirship proceedings. Your point is that you just didn't know which of all these notices of heirship proceedings that are out there you happen to be the relative of.
That's exactly right. And that's a good point because one of the things I did when I got this was try to determine what is the duty of an adopted child upon learning that he or she is adopted. And I'm not sure that this court wants to suggest that adopted children have a duty to go out and find out who their natural parents are.
Has the discovery rule ever applied under factual circumstances where I know that I've been injured, but since I have not been able to identify who it is that injured me, I'm not under any sort of obligation to do anything until I do. In other words,
I disagree with that. I think the discovery rule that as soon as you know you've been injured, you do have an obligation to go out and find and determine who injured you and determine to cover the facts on that.
So if she had known who it was that had failed to include her in the heirship, I guess when you have just said that if you know you're injured, mm-hmm. then you have the reason the statute of limitations applies. Once you discover the injury, then you've got a period of time in which to go out and find out who it is that harmed you.
Yes.
This seems to be a little bit kind of a funny area because the constructive notice is to the world that this heirship proceeding is going on.
Right.
So everybody in the world now knows, if not, I'm not included in that, I'm subject to harm.
Right.
And so now I've got a duty to go look and investigate to find out the identity. Why wouldn't the person who knows they're adopted, when they
She doesn't know that she's been excluded from a will. In this particular instance, she doesn't even know that there's a will out there. That, for all we know, the will could have disinherited her biological mother, or her biological mother may not have predeceased her biological grandmother. So she doesn't know that there's an injury.
Of course, she may know that her parent, her natural parent, has died without a will.
She may very well know that. That isn't supported by the evidence in this particular case.
I mean, any child would know that their parent might not still be living.
That is a possibility. I suspect that in light of the legislature's enactment protecting adoption records and providing when those adoption records may be unsealed, that this court would not want to adopt a rule that would require all adopted children to be put on notice and go out and try to determine, does my biological parent, have they disinherited me or not?
Did your client's child's illness start a limitations period run? I understand it's your position that she needed some good cause to uncover these adoption records. That was provided by the need to have medical history.
That was...
Which was sparked by an actual serious illness in her family.
That's correct.
So if the child had... if the child had gotten sick 20 years ago, would her obligation to have uncovered her natural family have arisen at that
no.
date so that there was
I don't think she had an obligation at all. I don't think adopted children have any obligation.
So the fact her child got sick gave a window,
that's
it
just,
didn't start anything.
Factually, that's just what started her down the road to find out.
In other words, she could have done all this in 20 more years, and it would have, there would be no limitations problem from your...
That's exactly correct. And I think this case is a lot like a case that this court refused some many years ago. It's Murphy versus Honeycutt, which is cited in our brief. That case involved a declaratory judgment action. It was an action that was brought to construe a will 13 years after the will had been admitted to probate. And the question there was, did the will provide for a life estate of a particular piece of property, or did the will provide for fee simple transfer of that property to the individual in question? Limitations was raised, and the question was, does the discovery rule apply to that particular instance? And what happened is, I believe it's the Texarkana Court of Appeals held that the time did not even begin running on that for purposes of the declaratory judgment action until there became an actual controversy. There was no controversy until 13 years later when...
But when an estate is closed and you don't get anything, then there a controversy?
I agree. With respect to most of these causes of action, that's true. And I agree with Mr. Wolf. December 31st, 1983, under ordinary circumstances, would be the instance when this cause of action would have accrued absent application of the discovery rule. With respect to the application...
Let me ask you about the duty that you say an executor owes under the probate code to have an ad litem appointed or seek the appointment of an ad litem by the probate court to identify lost or unknown heirs if, in fact, they don't locate the heir, the duty's been discharged and your client...
I agree. Yes,
would,
it has.
...would
absolutely
have no cause of action? Is that
absolutely.
How different is the diligence that must be exercised by the ad litem under those circumstances from the diligence we ordinarily require of a litigant under the discovery rule to discover a cause of action that might exist?
How does that differ? Is that the question?
Yes. The diligence that is required of an ad litem to locate a lost or unknown heir, how is that different from the diligence we ordinarily require under the discovery rule of a litigant to identify a cause of action they may have?
I'm not quite sure how to answer your question because I think they reflect two different duties, and it's hard to say that they're the same or that they differ. I think with respect to the diligence that a litigant is required to exercise to uncover his or her cause of action, that duty doesn't even come into play until the litigant has some facts to put him or her on notice.
And the fact that I learned that I've been adopted and providing for the tolling of any limitations period during minority status, why isn't an adopted child put on notice here? They may have a claim.
Because this is not a claim for wrongful adoption. This is a claim for the wrongful exclusion from an estate that didn't even occur at the time that she found out that she was adopted.
Why aren't they charged with notice that they may have a claim at some point?
I'll be honest with you. I have done a search of all 50 states, and I have been unable to find a case that places a duty on an adopted child to find out who his or her biological parents are upon learning that he or she is an adopted child.
Northrop, let me ask you a question. The statute says an adopted child can inherit from the natural parent. What, just from a public policy discussion, what would be wrong with putting the burden on the adopted child to seek out the identity of their adoptive parents if they intend to, I guess I should say, what is wrong with putting the burden on an adopted child when they become an adult to make a reasonable inquiry to discover their natural parents if they intend at some point in the future to assert an interest in an estate?
I'll answer that in two ways.
Here, didn't Ms. Little read an obituary or something and learn for the first time that there was money in this estate? And
I don't think that's in the record at all. I think the first time she learned there was an estate was after she confronted Frank Little, and he denied that she could exist or that she was who she said she was.
Why wouldn't it, when you're talking about adoption, your adopted child may want to learn about his or her parents. An adopted child may not want to know anything about his or her parents. The natural parents may want to know about their child. They may not want to know about the child. They may not even want their identity known. Why shouldn't we leave that the option with the adopted child and say, Dr. Child, when you become an adult, if you want to locate your parents, you must exercise reasonable diligence to do so, and not really pay so much attention to estates that get closed or don't get closed.
I agree with that sentiment 100%, and I think if this court imposes some sort of a limitation period and ultimately a duty on the child to find out if there's an inheritance out there, then it's going to require a lot of those adopted children to come forward. I think that process should be left alone and should be placed upon the parties most likely to know if there's somebody out there, and the parties who already have the duty to locate those.
But let's talk about the circumstances here. If the burden is on the adopted child to seek out the parents, then why wouldn't the statute of limitations run against an adopted child just like any other heir when the estate gets closed in that period of time? In other words, the burden would not be on the adopted child to begin at age 21, and you've got 2 years to discover it, because no harm has happened. Until the estate's closed, there's no harm. But the notice to an adopted child when the estate is filed is identical to a notice to anyone else who knows who their heirs are. And for an adopted child to then attack the closing of the estate, they must show that during that period of the estate, while the whole estate is open, while everybody's on notice, they exercised reasonable diligence to discover their identity. Why can't that be a rule here?
I'll answer that in two ways. I think, first of all, the publication of the notice in the paper is probably not proper notice constitutionally under Mullane versus Central Hanover Trust, which involves a case of beneficiaries of a trust who were to be given notice by virtue of publication. But secondly, I think the reason that you would not want to require required that the limitations run at that point in time is for the reason that the legislature sealed those adoption records and requires good cause, and not every adopted child may be able to satisfy the good cause requirement. In this particular case, it was fortunate that my client, that good cause arose in 1987 when there were medical reasons for her to look into that. But the legislature sealed those records for a reason,
the statute that permits an adopted child to inherit from a natural parent would not be good cause to learn to confirm the identity of.
I can't answer that. I don't know whether the courts would consider that constitutes good cause or not.
Sir, any other questions? Thank you.
What if her adopted parents, Smith's adopted parents, had never told her that she was adopted?
I think the individual would have to have some basic information that they were adopted. I had not given that any thought, Your Honor.
Well, I mean, would that be a situation where the discovery rule might apply?
Could be, Your Honor.
But if you're told at age 10 that you're adopted, then that changes the whole scenario.
Yes, sir.
Was there summary judgment proof that Dr. Little knew there was another child?
No, ma'am. The summary judgment evidence from our point of view, and I believe viewed favorably to the plaintiff, was Dr. Little told Mrs. Smith when she called him for the first time in 1989 that he had great difficulty accepting her premise.
No, was there conflicting evidence from the other side?
None that I'm aware of, Your Honor. I thought that the evidence was clear that there was no evidence that Dr. Little was aware if Thelma had an illegitimate child that she had done so.
How about other family members?
The evidence...
Mr. Northrop cites a conversation or a statement made by Mrs. Smith that she was informed by family members that they knew that she was out there.
Well, I'm trying to remember Mrs. LeBrun's deposition. Mrs. LeBrun was like 3 years old. That was Thelma's baby sister when 1932. And Mr. Northrop mentioned some conversation that might have occurred between Mrs. LeBrun and the plaintiff. But frankly, Your Honor, I haven't looked at that lately. I think if there was testimony on that, it was very equivocal.
Who was it that the grandmother told on her deathbed that her daughter had had an illegitimate child?
This is the very conversation, I believe, Your Honor, that was just being inquired about. And the best that I can remember, Mrs. LeBrun's deposition. Mrs. LeBrun is a woman who was Thelma's younger sister, who was about age 3 in 1932. And I honestly, Your Honor, do not remember any testimony about a deathbed conversation.
Can you tell me quickly what would be the normal statute of limitations in bringing a claim for an heirship once a will has been probated? What's the normal statute of limitations for coming forward and claiming that you are an heir?
I believe it's 4 years.
For four years from what?
It would be, in this instance, 4 years from the date that the estate is closed.
Not from the date the estate was initially, the will was initially probated?
That's my understanding. That's the way we have looked at it thus far, Your Honor, is that the cutoff date for any cause of action would have been December 31st, 1987.
And that's based on what? That case law or statute? What do you base that on? Just in a normal situation where an heir comes in and says, I've claimed.
As far as the inception date?
When does the statute of limitations begin to run? On that term?
Possibly, Your Honor, we could have referred to some case law on it. I do not have it in front of me.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
That concludes the argument in the first cause. The court will take a brief recess.